KUCI Irvine. Opinions and views expressed on this program are those of the speakers only and do not represent those of UCI, KUCI, the UC Board of Regents, or any law firm. Nor should any part of this show be taken as legal advice. This is The Docket. FM KUCI, The Docket. I'm Evan Simon. Welcome to the program. 824-5824-949. UCI, KUCI is my telephone number. Thank you for being here. So last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that many in the technology world have been keeping a close eye on. And the case was Bilski versus Dahl, and it raises some very interesting questions about the sorts of technology that is patentable. You know, I remember my college roommate trying to impress upon me that, in his words, quote, software patents are evil. And, you know, and I think this is a very interesting case because it calls into question how the law thinks about and conceptualizes computer software and where lines are drawn from other sorts of ideas like business methods. So joining me to parse out these complicated questions, we have Lester Savitt. He's a partner at the international law firm Jones Day here in Irvine and my boss.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Actually, I should turn on the microphones first. So now.
Thank you, Evan, for having me on the show.
And Dan Burke, he's a professor of law at the all-new UCI Law School. Professor, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Evan. It's great to be here at UCI. Great to be part of a brand-new law school, and appreciate the chance to be here and talk with you.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we start at the beginning here, because we're talking about patents, we're talking about intellectual property, some complicated, and seemingly complicated area of law, and I think there are some basic misconceptions in terms of what is a patent versus a copyright, and those sorts of questions we can sort of start off with and try to, you know, start at a clean slate here so that everybody coming to the discussion can, you know, really understand what we're going to get into. So, Lester, what exactly is a patent?
Well, a patent, as distinct from a trademark or copyright, is a grant by the U.S. government of an exclusive right for a set period of time to practice an invention in exchange for disclosure. The period of time of the patent is limited, so when the patent expires, then the information then becomes public. Mm-hmm. That's really the trade-off, and the idea is to encourage innovation, to get inventors, whether they're individual inventors or businesses, to disclose their inventions, and then they become public after a set period of time.
Yeah. And Evan, you know, we usually, and I emphasize here usually, think of patents as applying to things that are technological, you know, things that are mechanical, things that are electronic, things that are compositions of matter, industrial processes. And you mentioned copyrights. We usually, and I say usually, think of copyrights as applying to things that are artistic or aesthetic, mm-hmm. like art and music and poetry. The fly in the ointment, the problem child here is the one you mentioned a moment ago, computer software, because computer software can be subject to copyright, but computer software, according to the courts, is also patentable. So it's one of the very few things that kind of sits between that realm of the technological on the one hand, that we know patents are supposed to cover, and the realm of the artistic or symbolic on the other hand, that supposedly is more for copyrights.
Right. And Professor, patents are rooted in the U.S. Constitution?
Patents and copyrights, both. The Constitution provides that Congress can create a patent law and can secure to inventors, as Lester was telling you, for a limited period of time, the exclusive right to their inventions, and that means that once you have this patent, you can prevent anybody else from practicing that invention unless they get your permission. So they have to pay you or ask you, or if you want to, you can practice it yourself.
It's a pretty powerful right, right, Lester?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that many businesses invest a lot of money and a lot of time and thought into obtaining them, because, of course, it allows them to recoup some of their investment in developing a invention into a commercial product, and you know that allows them to earn their money back,
right?
In a way. Otherwise, you know, almost all inventions, once they become commercial products, can be reverse engineered, and then the second comer would really be profiting from innovations.
And do you have to apply for a patent? How do you get a patent, Lester?
The process is yes, you describe your invention and file that description with the U.S. Patent Office. It's called the patent application. And at the end of the patent application, you write these numbered paragraphs. Each one is just one sentence, called claims. And each claim then defines meets and bounds, basically the boundaries of what is your invention. And that has to be different from what has been in the past, what we patent attorneys call prior art.
And these requirements in order to obtain a patent, you said it has to be different from what's in the prior art. It has to be novel, right? What else?
Generally, it has to be novel. It has to be not obvious, which means that technically it's new, but it has to be new in some way that wouldn't have been obvious to somebody working in that field. And it has to be useful. But of course, I think what we're ultimately getting to is before you get to any of those tests, it has to fall under this category of what we call patentable subject matter. Not every single idea, in a raw sense, abstract idea, is patentable in itself or is really subject to being put into an inventive form that would be patentable.
Well, why not, Professor?
Well, the courts have said that there are certain kinds of things that are either too fundamental, you know, that we don't want to give patents on because we want everybody to be able to use them, or that haven't been changed enough by humans to really be an invention. So there's a so-called products of nature doctrine that says if I just go for a walk in the woods and find an interesting rock or an interesting plant, I can't patent that. If I change it somehow, if I extract chemicals from it, or if I create something different out of it, then it becomes an invention. But we don't allow people to patent things that are straight out of nature. We don't allow people to patent things that are just ideas. We really want them to have changed or altered them in some way because a fundamental scientific principle or a fundamental idea like a mathematical formula or a chemical formula, we want everyone to be able to use that to build their patentable inventions on, so we don't give that fundamental idea to anyone.
824-5824-949-UCI-KUCI. It's The Docket. I'm Evan Simon. We're speaking with Lester Savitt of Jones Day and Professor Dan Burke of the UCI Law School about patent law leading up to a discussion of the Bilski case that was heard last week before the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Well, Lester, you mentioned some of the theories behind why society and why we grant patents in this country. And you mentioned this idea that, you know, you're disclosing your invention to the public. Is the public really enriched from that?
In my view, yes, very much so. And I think that's been the policy of the United States since the Constitution was written.
And what are some of the other policies behind granting patents?
Well, you know, Evan, patents do a lot of things. As Lester's already told you, our theory, at least, is that patents should promote innovation by giving people a reward for the investment that they've made in creating an invention, and should enrich the public by disclosing to the public how to make and use that invention so everyone could use it after the patent expires. But if you actually look at what goes on out in business, people are doing all kinds of things with patents. So there's empirical research now that shows us that most patents are never licensed and, in fact, are never used. So why do businesses spend money on them? Well, they might be using them for other things. They might be using them to defend against a potential lawsuit from someone else who has patents. They might be using them for business deals, right? You've got some cash, Lester has some technology, and I have some patents I can bring to the table, so we can form a partnership of some sort. Some people are using patents to attract investment from venture capitalists. We know that venture capitalists, for reasons that remain mysterious to everyone, really like to invest in businesses that have patents. They think that's a good investment. So you may want to get a patent for a lot of business reasons, even besides the policies that Lester identified for us a minute ago.
Well, if I might jump in here, Evan, part of the reason why there are so many patents out there that really aren't asserted or otherwise used, or maybe even the invention doesn't become a commercial product, is that the process has to start at a relatively early time. So typically you have to file your patent application within a year of your first public use, and if you're smart and you have good lawyers, you're doing it, you're not waiting till the last day. So let's say 6 months after your initial idea is somewhat concrete, but you're certainly nowhere near knowing whether you're going to have a commercial product or what the commercial product is going to look like. So in order to protect your invention, you really have to basically overprotect. You have to file on a lot of things. You just don't know ahead of time which of those is going to become commercially significant and which aren't. In fact, there are procedures that go on for years and years where you might want to add on to your original disclosure. You might want to re-examine or reissue. So it can be years and years down the line before you actually change those claims. Remember, I referred to those numbered sentences at the end of the patent to cover your commercial product, and in fact, that might be something valuable you didn't even recognize when you first filed your patent application.
Some people have referred to that, not entirely in a positive way, as the patent lottery. You file on lots of patents, you hope you strike it rich on one of them, certainly that's true in many industries. You can identify a patent that's been a real blockbuster and has really helped a company recoup its costs, but then you look at their patent portfolio, and as Lester's saying, you see that they actually have dozens or hundreds of other patents that are kind of sitting there not being used.
And just so that people have an idea as to really what's at stake in a patent lawsuit, a typical patent lawsuit, how much money might be asked for in an infringement action?
Well, in the time that I've been practicing law, the numbers have gone up drastically, and that's one of the reasons that businesses have become a lot more interested in patents, and there's been a lot more litigation. So it used to be, actually, when I started practicing 30 years ago, if you had a multimillion-dollar recovery, that was considered big. Then it went through a phase where if you had tens of millions of dollars, that was some of the largest recoveries maybe in history, or certainly for that year or for that period. Now, typically in a patent infringement suit between large corporations, the claim, not necessarily what will happen at the end of the day, but the claim will be in the hundreds of millions of dollars or more.
And that's why a lot of people are concerned about all of these unused patents that are sitting around. They want to have the freedom to operate, to start new businesses, to engage in new enterprises, but you've got to be really careful. Someone may have a patent on your technology or on your process out there, and even if you're just challenged by that patent, even if it turns out that you weren't in fact an infringer, or if it turns out that a patent's no good, it can be incredibly expensive for a business to defend those lawsuits. And so a lot of businesses get very nervous about the prospect of patent litigation and about all the patents that are sitting around out there.
And when we come back on KUCI, we'll further discuss the issue of software patents and whether or not the software industry does need to be worried about patent protection. It's The Docket on KUCI and KUCI.org.
I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use.
KUCI Era.
Your number one source for
new music. 88.9 FM.
We are all, by any practical definition of the word, foolproof and incapable of error.
Fairy residence, Tooth speaking. Sorry, there's no credit fairy here. What's that? He magically raises your credit score? Yeah, there's no credit fairy. But you can improve your credit by paying bills on time and keeping your credit card balances low. Money under your pillow? Sorry, kids only.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. Brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
If your toddler falls in the pool, you think you'll hear this. But what you'll really hear is this. It happens quickly and silently. About 260 children younger than 5 drown in pools each year. That's about one nursery school class each month. Put a fence around your pool. Place an alarm on doors leading to the pool area. For more pool safety tips, visit the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission website at cpsc.gov.
Have lots of fun on the internet, so don't go places you might regret. On GruffSNet, safety tips for you for surfing the net and staying cool. Listen close and you will agree, McGruff and Scruff know their net safety. Remember net safety, and you can have fun. Learn about anything under the sun. Your parents for their advice, and tell them if someone isn't acting nice. Net safety is your safety net.
For more information on how to be safe on the internet, visit my website at www.mcgruff.org.
A message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
The opinions and views expressed on this program are those of the speakers only and do not represent those of UCI, KUCI, the UC Board of Regents, or any law firm, nor should any part of the show be taken as legal advice. This is The Docket. Point 9 FM KUCI, The Docket. I'm Evan Simon. Welcome back to the program. 824-5824-949 UCI KUCI. And joining me in studio, we have Lester Savitt. He's a partner at the law firm Jones Day. And we have Dan Burke, professor of law at the brand new UCI Law School. As we continue our discussion of patents leading up to the Inri Bilski case that was heard last week before the U.S. Supreme Court. And before we went to break, we're about to talk about sort of the next step in our discussion, which is the patentability of software. We talked about the theories of patentability, the requirements of patentability, and we talked about how some things are not patentable, like mathematical formulas, algorithms, abstract ideas, laws of nature. But what about software? And as we were talking about during the break, it is sort of difficult to imagine a world without software and without computers, but the patent office early on didn't take too kindly to the notion of software patents, right, Professor? You know what? My mistake. Why don't we turn on the microphones before we begin the discussion?
You're absolutely right, Evan. And that's because, as we mentioned in the beginning of the show, software is a very strange creature. We said sometimes software is copyrightable. It's subject to copyright, which normally applies to artistic and literary creations. But it's also subject to patent law, which applies to technological creations. You know, Mitch Kapoor, who's one of the developers of the Lotus company, the Lotus program, used to like to say that software is a machine built of text, right? Usually we think of machines as being built of plastic or metal or other kinds of tangible items, but he said software is really a machine built of text. And if you know something about software, at one level it looks like symbols that can be read by a programmer, like code. And so that's what caused Congress to say, hey, maybe this goes in the copyright box, because copyright is about symbolic textual things, like art and music and books. But at another level, that software code configures a machine. And we know that machines are part of the patent law. The machine should be covered by patents. And so software doesn't fit very well in either box. And you're right, early on, the patent office was very uncomfortable about the idea of having this code, the software, being part of the patent system.
Gottschalk versus Benson, a method of converting numerals from binary coded decimal to pure binary format. That sound like sounds just like an algorithm. That's not patentable, right? And what did the patent office and the courts say about that type of invention?
Well, the patent statute that Lester described for us at the top of the hour says that you can patent machines, you can patent compositions of matter, you can patent articles of manufacture and processes. And some people would say, well, is software a machine? Is software a process? Those categories make it look like maybe it fits into the patent box. But we also said that things like mathematical equations and laws of nature are not patentable. And so the early decisions by the Supreme Court in particular said, we think that this algorithm that you talked about in the Gottschalk case, it involves mathematics. And so we think it's fundamental. It's part of this laws of nature rule that we say is unpatentable. So software is not going to be patentable. And as a consequence, for a long time, the industry had to rely solely on copyright for their patent or for their intellectual property protection.
Lester, you're going to...
Yeah, I think one of the things that maybe your listeners might not appreciate is that the patent laws are written in kind of general form. They were written for these purposes a long time ago. And software is a good example of a category, a very, very important category of inventions, didn't exist at the time the laws were written. So now you would have, if going up into the 70s, 80s, 90s, and you know even now, dealing with the fact that the courts are deciding whether things are patentable subject matter or not patentable subject matter, because the legislature really passed the laws in the broadest terminology and didn't define these fine points, nor could it have, because it would have had to have looked into the future and seen these inventions, and that's where we are now, too. I mean, we can't imagine, really, we can't expect our legislatures to see into the future, to see what kind of inventions are going to be important.
That's absolutely right. And you know, some people look at that generality of the law as being a bug, a problem. You know, so, we don't know if software is patentable. Oh, we don't know if nanotechnology is patentable. But really, as Lester's describing it to you, it's a feature. It's a good feature of that law, because you can't predict what the next new technology is going to be. And so we have a general law that the courts and the patent office can look at. And as new things come along, they can apply that general law to the specific facts and incorporate that new technology into the patent system.
The patent statute was written in the 1950s.
The current one was passed
in the 1950s. So the court in the Gottschalk case basically said that even though the claim in that case did recite computer hardware, it was essentially meaningless, because the only application of this formula was in the context of a computer, right?
Right, and as you described it before, it was an algorithm for converting one type of symbol into another type of symbol, and so the court said, that looks to us like mathematics, that looks to us like it's too abstract, and as we said before, we don't like to patent things that are mathematical or completely abstract or that are laws of nature, so sorry software industry, no patents for you.
And then the Supreme Court takes up a case, Diamond versus Deere. And that involved a process of operating a rubber molding press with the aid of a digital computer.
Yeah.
And
Now the Supreme Court kind of did a little bit of a turnaround there in some ways. In the case you're describing, they said, well, we think that this process involving the software that's being claimed in the patent, we think that is patentable. But, of course, you can see the difference between those two cases, right? The first one is sort of very abstract conversion of one kind of numerical notation into another kind. When you get to the Diamond case, now we're talking about good, tangible, solid industrial processes, right? We're making tires. We're curing rubber, and we're using the digital processor and the algorithm in the digital processor to know how long the tire should be in the heated mold. And the Supreme Court said, well, that looks to us like that's a good industrial process. It produces a solid, tangible outcome. So, yeah, that one's going to be patentable.
824-5824-949 UCI-KUCI. It's the docket. I'm Evan Simon with Lester Savitt and Dan Burke. Talking about software patents. And so Diamond versus Deere gets handed down, and the Federal Circuit comes up with the Freeman-Walter-Abel test. What's that?
Well, I'm not sure anybody ever really knew. Over a long period of time, the courts went through this process that we talked about a moment ago of trying to decide how this general principle applied to the specific facts, and they were looking for things that were very much like the distinction I just drew between the abstract changing of symbols and notation into a different kind of symbols and notation that the Supreme Court said was unpatentable, and the good industrial process that produces tires that they said should be patentable. And so there was a long period of time where the courts developed various pretty complicated tests to say, all right, is the output of this process, is the purpose of this software to give us something that looks more like tires, or is it to give us something that looks more like abstract mathematical notation? And if it's the latter, we'll say it's patentable. If it's the former, we'll say it's not.
And there's this theory that by programming a computer, you're essentially creating a new machine, right?
Well, Lester described the claims of the patent to us a few minutes ago. As I said, the statute allows you to patent articles of manufacture, compositions of matter, machines, and processes. So if you want to get a patent on something, you got to make it look like one of those four things. And if you're a good patent attorney, you draft your claims in terms of those things. And so one of the ways that people tried to claim software is by saying, look, software configures computers. It configures a general purpose computer. And when you do that, you've got a different machine than you had before you put the software in there. We could hardwire everything, right? We could have dedicated word processors. We could have dedicated spreadsheet machines. We decided not to do that. We decided to have general-purpose machines that would be configured by software. But that configured machine, they reasoned, is equivalent to the hardwired version. And so you really have a new machine once you've configured it with software. And that machine ought to be patentable just like the hardwired version would be.
And Lester, how would you write claims as a practitioner to take advantage of that notion?
Well, I can tell you from my own experience, because I was already practicing law in the early 80s, and when Diamond versus Deere came out, we all of a sudden took our claims that before that time might have been criticized for just claiming an abstract process, and we just added the word electronically to each one of the phrases in the claims. So, for example, we'd say electronically storing information, electronically communicating information. And so that was how we tied what could have been considered an abstract idea or mathematical algorithm to a machine. And that was our interpretation of Diamond versus Deere at the time. It was a simple fix. It still obtained our client's objectives. But what was interesting was that this was a real game changer, Diamond versus Deere, because even at that time, or prior to Diamond versus Deere, there was very little effort being made to patent software. So when I was dealing with software writers, they actually had a hard time believing that their own inventions were inventions, because it's like writing a book for them. They would just think, hey, all they're doing is using English language. They're building a book sentence by sentence, and they never really, they're looking at the trees and not the forest. It was really a service when the patent attorneys came in and said, hey, you know what, this forest is actually an invention. And the way that we claimed it, if you go back, in fact, in talking to you prior to this show, Evan, I showed you the patent that we wrote and obtained in the early 80s. We just drew a bunch of boxes and claimed it as a flow chart.
And Professor, are computer scientists inventors too?
Well, depends on what you mean by the word inventor, right? Lawyers like to mince words. And for purposes of the patent statute, an inventor is somebody who has something patentable. Right now, we certainly think that computer scientists are creating things that are innovative, that are technological, that make everyone's life better, and that ought to get the kinds of rewards that we talked about to encourage them to create new inventions. So we've said, yeah, we think that ought to be patentable. In a more abstract sense, I think we could have a discussion about whether a computer scientist or inventor, but they do some pretty amazing stuff, and so I think the public looks at the things that are done now with digital processors and would say, maybe that's our modern version of Thomas Edison or our modern version of Alexander Graham Bell.
And so there is this idea that that a computer program is creating something that's useful, concrete, or results in something that's tangible, right? And that's a requirement for patentability under this this Diamond versus Deere-esque standard, right?
Yeah, as we said, in Diamond versus Deere, they were producing basically tires. They were curing rubber. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's concrete, that's tangible, that's a solid industrial output, so we want to say that process involving the software is patentable. But then as you start to look around, we use software for all kinds of things, right? We use software to do accounting. We use software to produce video images. We use software to produce outputs that don't necessarily look as solid as a rubber tire. And so we have to ask the question, all right, is that video output, is that accounting number, is that spreadsheet, is that solid and tangible enough for us to say that that software is going to be patentable or not?
I like where you're taking us with that. It's The Docket. I'm Evan Simon. We're speaking with Lester Savitt and Dan Burke on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And so the notion that we do use software for many things, I think, brings us into a discussion of business method patents, right? What exactly is a business method, Lester?
Well, I think that a lot of people who are smarter than me are struggling with that issue and have been for many years and probably will continue to into the future. The way that it's come up with the courts reviewing it is a business method, is that an abstract idea or is that a patentable process? And we thought that this was decided in 1998 with a decision by the Federal Circuit, that's the Federal Court of Appeals in State Street Bank, who said there's no reason just because a method is tied to a business or a business method per se, there's no reason why that can't be a patented process.
Remember, Evan, that little quote I had from Mitch Kapoor earlier that he liked to say software is a machine built out of text. Well, the implication of that computers that are configured by software are infused with language is that anything you can describe in language can be modeled or accomplished using a digital processor, including things that you would do in business, like accounting, like inventory. And so we can create software that will accomplish those tasks. And once we do that, somebody like Lester can draft us a patent claim that says, all right, I'm going to go through this accounting method, or I'm going to go through this investment portfolio method, or I'm going to go through this inventory method using a digital processor. And now it's tied to a machine in some way. And so we began to have a lot of patents on things that used to do with pencil and paper, or maybe you even used to do in your head, calculations. But now they're being done in a computer, and patent attorneys like Lester can draft claims to get them into the patent system.
Even something like managing hedge funds?
Absolutely. And that, of course, is the kind of a patent that's at issue in this Bilski case that's coming up in the Supreme Court. You know, you could decide how to make investments with a pencil and paper. You could decide how to make investments by just being really smart and making calculations and estimates in your head. Or you could create some software that does that work for you. And once you create that software and once you tie it to a machine, gosh, it sure looks like something that ought to be patentable.
Right, because generally software is patentable, right? If it creates a useful, concrete, or tangible result, right?
Exactly. And so the question then is making a lot more money in a hedge fund a useful, concrete, and tangible result? Gosh, I think it's pretty useful. I would love to have my investment increase by using this software. So if you're someone who invented this method of making my money double and triple and making my net value go up, I might think that you deserve a patent for that.
824-5824-949 UCI KUCI. And I think that does bring us to the Bilski case. And what exactly was the invention here? We alluded to it, a method of hedging risks in commodities trading, right?
Exactly, and moving funds around between different kinds of accounts using a certain type of computer software methodology, using a process that was tied to a digital processor.
And Lester, in this case, were the claims tied to a particular machine or a computer?
Yes, the attempt was. I think that there were some claims that were more abstract, basically, than others, but all of the claims were rejected. There was an attempt, and maybe we should tell your viewers, you're not limited to just one claim. So in a patent application, you can claim what you consider to be your invention in different ways. So I believe there were some claims that were more abstract as a raw process, and there were others that were tied to some, like a computer, yes.
And this goes back to what Lester was telling us about at the beginning of the show, right? That unlike a copyright that you can get automatically when you write code or when you paint a picture or when you write a poem, you have to go through this examination process to get a patent. You have to send this application that Lester described off to the patent office. It's looked at by a patent examiner who is somebody with a technical background, someone with skill in that particular technology. And the examination corps there in the patent office is responsible for trying to weed out the patents that aren't useful, that aren't new, that are too obvious, or that don't fit into the subject matter categories. And so they've been responsible for looking at these software-type patents and saying, okay, is this something that looks more like a rubber tire? Is it something that's tangible that we should allow to be patented? Or do we reject this application as being too abstract in the way that Lester described?
You know, Evan, I think it should be appreciated that whether Bilski intended it or not, this case, 11 years after the State Street case, is in essence a test case. And the fact that 11 years have passed is really the result more of how long it takes to get through the Patent Office, get through the Court of Appeals, and get up to the Supreme Court with this issue. But the actual Bilski patent application was filed very soon after the State Street case. And the Patent Office, whether, as I say, I don't know that Bilski wanted his patent application to be the test case. I don't know that, but maybe someday we'll talk to him and find that out. But the Patent Office certainly did consider it that way. And in fact, before the rejections came out of the Patent Office, the board issued a 70-page opinion.
Wow.
Which is very unusual for it to be that long. So they knew this was going to be a matter that was going to be of great interest and would continue up to the Court of Appeals and now up to the Supreme Court.
And part of what's happened in that period of time, in that 11 years that has turned this into a test case, is the expansion of patents under these theories that we've talked about. I said earlier that anything that can be described in language can be modeled or accomplished using a digital processor. And so as people began to do this, folks got very uncomfortable with some of the things that were being patented. For example, you might think it's a great idea to be able to patent a method of moving funds around to make more money in hedge funds. But would you be so comfortable with a patent that allows you to create a tax shelter, right? And we have a big controversy now about people who have tried to patent certain methods of lowering their income tax. Is that something we really want to encourage? Is that something we ought to allow to be patentable? People become uncomfortable about patents on other types of methods of accomplishing things, like a patent on a method of plotting a novel is a patent that's out there. Some people say, well, that we're uncomfortable about that. My personal favorite, which I'm sure Lester loves, is there are a couple of patents on method of drafting patents, which is a little bit recursive. Right. But you know, people began to say, wow, this method of using the claims to patent different activities, as long as you throw in something about a digital processor or something about software, is leading to patents on things that we think we're uncomfortable with. And so there's been more and more criticism over this period of time of the scope of things that are being patented, and more interest in places like Congress and places like the Supreme Court in taking another look at this issue to see if we really have gotten the patentable subject matter right.
And is it the idea that you would be, as the patent holder, able to prevent somebody else from practicing that invention, right?
That's what patents are all about.
And in the briefs that were filed to the Supreme Court, the statement is made, and I have no reason to believe it's not true, that 15,000 business method patents have been issued by the Patent Office since the State Street Bank case. And you got to remember, going back to that idea, that you have to file a patent application in a timely manner, fairly fast, before when you come up with the idea, or you lose it. So those folks, those 15,000 folks that filed those patent applications, didn't have the option of saying, hey, let's see how the Bilski case is decided, and then I'll decide whether I'm going to spend the money and the time and effort to try and patent my business idea. You either file your application and take your chances that it's going to end up being on the right side of the law, or you lose it.
Yeah. And so Bilski's patent for managing hedge funds, the PTO rejects it. It goes up to the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit also rejects the patent, but on a slightly new theory, right, Professor?
Yeah, because the Federal Circuit had decided this previous case that Lester mentioned, the State Street case, that again had to do with a numerical output from some software, and they had talked about this test that you indicated about being, you know, concrete and tangible. They thought that the numerical output in those kinds of cases was sufficiently concrete and tangible. But as I said, people got very uncomfortable with that, with the tax method patents and the plotting the novel patents and so on. So the Court of Appeals that looked at this case coming out of the Patent Office said, well, we think that maybe the real test should be a machine or transformation test, that you should either have something that's connected to a machine, and Lester talked to us about how you might do that in patent claims, or that transforms things in some way, like that case we talked about, Diamond versus Deere, where you're curing rubber and producing tires. And so they tried to move away from some of these more abstract things that people were uncomfortable with, and created quite a bit of controversy in doing so. First of all, because we're still not sure that that's quite the right test. Secondly, because it kind of pulled the rug out from under people who were relying on the previous cases that they decided to file patents on things under that previous test. So they kind of created a real sea change for folks like Lester, who are trying to comply with the subject matter requirements.
And when we come back here on KUCI, Bilski tries to get his patent back from the U.S. Supreme Court. It's The Docket on KUCI and KUCI.org.
Lester Beth, KUCI, 88.9 FM, Cuyamá.
Kayo'y nakikinig sa KUCI.
Estás escuchando a KUCI, 88.9.
Vous écoutez KUCI.
Vous écoutez la radio KUCI, 88.9 FM.
You're listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
Susie Orman here with a message from the FDIC. Recently, I got a letter from a woman who took all of her money out of the bank and put it in a shoebox. You know what I told her? Put it back in an FDIC member bank now. If you stay within coverage limits, you can't lose a penny. Go to myfdicinsurance.gov and click on Edie the Estimator to make sure your money is safe and sound. That's Edie at myfdicinsurance.gov. The more you know, the safer your money.
The opinions and views expressed on this program are those of the speakers only and do not represent those of UCI, KUCI, the UC Board of Regents, or any law firm, nor should any part of the show be taken as legal advice. This is The Docket. Point out of KUCI, The Docket. I'm Evan Simon. Welcome back to the program. We're joined by Lester Savitt of Jones Day and Dan Burke of the UCI Law School talking about Bilski trying to get his patent from the U.S. Supreme Court. The Patent Office said no. The Federal Circuit said no. And now, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Bilski versus Dahl. And so what did Bilski argue, Lester, at the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, there's really two separate arguments, and the first one is that the Patent Office too narrowly defined what the patentable subject matter is, and the Supreme Court, and in fact the legislature, has in a series of cases, including Diamond versus Deere and the famous Chakrabarty case, which is on the biotech side of things, really said, hey, everything should be, the categories of patentable subject matter should be interpreted very broadly for the very reason that we mentioned before, which is the legislature is not going to be deciding every time some new technology comes along. You really want it to be broad. You want people to be creative. You want people to come up with stuff that the legislature is, you know, never going to learn about in advance, and to reward those people. Those are the ones who deserve the reward best. So the questions are, well, where are the narrow lines drawn? Because in this case, at what point do you then go into abstract ideas and other, let's say, intangible, indefinite areas that I think everyone agrees shouldn't be patentable? So the petitioner has said that this machine or transformation test is really a new test that the Patent Office has come up with, and it's way too narrow. It's going to exclude a lot of important inventions. It's going to exclude things in the future that are an important part of the economy. And in fact, their language, the petitioner's language, talks about if they're ruled, if the Patent Office test is adopted, really, that that's going to root the patent laws in the industrial age, which I kind of like that phrase. I got a kick out of it. The second argument really is more to what Bilski's process is, and really says if the proper test was applied, then Bilski's claims of a hedging method should in fact be patentable. So now the Supreme Court now doesn't have to decide really cleanly in favor of one side or the other. It could disagree with the Patent Office rule and still not give Bilski his patent. So that's an interesting splitting the baby result, and many people think that's the way they're going to go.
Yeah. And the great thing, Evan, about living in the age of the Internet is that you can get out on the Internet almost immediately after a Supreme Court argument and find descriptions, and soon you'll find actual transcripts of what was actually said in those arguments. By all indications, I wasn't there, and I don't think that Lester was there for that argument live, but all indications by our friends and colleagues who were there, it was what we call a very hot bench, right? The justices were very engaged. They were very interested in the issue. They were really peppering the attorneys who were making the arguments with a lot of interesting questions. It looked like some of them had pretty strong feelings about it, especially Justice Sotomayor, interestingly, was really pretty revved up about the issue. So the Supreme Court, I think, knows this is an important issue. I think they know that it's vital to innovation and to the advance of technology in the way that Lester's describing to us. And they seem to be really engaged and have really thought pretty deeply about this particular set of issues.
Well, here's something that Sonia Sotomayor did say. She said, so how do we limit it to something that is reasonable? Meaning if we don't limit it to inventions or to technology, as some amici have, or to some tie or tether, borrowing from the Solicitor General's phraseology, to the sciences, to the useful arts, then why not patent the method of speed dating?
So what she's talking about here is the fact that the United States is kind of unique in our patent law, in that we have been so accommodating to having software patents, and we've been so accommodating to having so-called business method patents, business methods that are implemented through software and other methods. The rest of the world doesn't really do that. If you go to Europe, you'll have a lot of trouble getting a patent on one of these kinds of things, because they actually have laws that say it must be tied somehow to the technological arts. Right? It's got to be something like that tire that we talked about before, something that's very concrete, and in the phrase that Lester likes so much, it's got to be really kind of the industrial age rather than the information age. So what the justice is talking about here is, how do we make sure that we can promote innovation in the information age without having very abstract kinds of things become patentable, like a method of speed dating, or like a method of plotting a novel, or like, as we said before, a method of writing a patent.
And what did the government say? I imagine they echoed some of those concerns to the Supreme Court.
Well, remember that this is coming up out of the patent office. It's styled Bilski versus Dahl, right? So Bilski's the inventor. Dahl is the commissioner of the patent office. And so Bilski is arguing in the way that Lester described, that I really deserve my patent for these reasons. And the representative from the patent office is there defending the decision of the patent office to apply this standard in the way that the examiners did when they rejected that patent.
824-5824-949 UCI-KUCI. So did the Bilski patent, we said that this somewhat covers software, somewhat is more abstract in a business method. Do we think that the U.S. Supreme Court decision might affect actual computer software patents?
Well, people are very concerned about that. They had this concrete, tangible result test where they were trying to follow that and draft patents for innovative software. Then they got this new test that we talked about a machine or transformation, and so they want to try and figure out how to comply with that. Now they're going to get a new ruling from the Supreme Court. They're going to want to comply with that, and there is this concern that some things that were patentable, or some things that we've learned how to draft claims for, might be excluded by the Supreme Court's test. It really depends on which direction the court goes. Are they going to be more concerned about things being too abstract, or are they going to be more concerned about excluding real inventions that would promote innovation?
And Lester, is there a clean way to be able to draw a line between computer software and maybe business methods implemented in a computer?
Well, the there might be a carve-out of the business method category of patents of methods of organizing human activity, and you do see that in the briefing in the Supreme Court, where you would say that, you know, a method of organizing human activity, such as hedging, methods of hedging prices.
Or speed dating,
would not be patentable, and it would be, you know, it's not really a business method in the sense that that was considered in the past. But, you know, patentable subject matter per se is not the only gatekeeper to patentability, and what I was seeing in the reported arguments in the Supreme Court, and even in a federal district court ruling on the invalidity of a software type of patent as not covering patentable subject matter, was a bit of a confusion as to, and that's going back to this obviousness standard of patentability. So that, you know, you would now look back in the context of Bilski, which, again, is not dealing with obviousness. You still have to, even after you establish patentable subject matter, you still got to be you got to be novel, and you got to be non-obvious. Saying, hey, software is really just an old machine, a computer, and an algorithm. And therefore, under Bilski, that's not going to be patentable. And in fact, it seems to me there is this confusion, because that's really talking about obviousness. If you're going to have software in a computer, Diamond versus Deere a long time ago, almost 30 years ago, said that's patentable subject matter. The next question is, But okay, is that obvious? In other words, are you merely just putting some instructions into the computer that would have been pretty obvious?
Evan, I think this really goes back to a fundamental policy that Lester told us about a few minutes ago, which I've talked about with Professor Mark Lemley of Stanford University in our new book, The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It. The legislature can't foresee what new technologies are going to be. The legislature can't foresee nanotechnology or green tech or whatever the next thing is. And so as Lester said before, you want to have a very broad, flexible statute that can apply to new technologies. And the Supreme Court's clearly very worried about that particular policy. The message we've been getting from the Supreme Court for the past 5 years or so is you can't have these bright line rules that are kind of binary, patentable or unpatentable according to subject matter, according to something else. The Supreme Court keeps telling the lower courts, really we need flexible rules. And so my prediction for the outcome of this Bilski case is that we're going to get the same message from the Supreme Court again. They're going to say, look, you need to have a very flexible rule that encompasses lots of kinds of innovation. You can't just cut off certain kinds of new inventions prematurely. And yes, it's true, that's going to be more work for the lower courts, and it's probably going to be more work for the patent office to figure out how that flexible rule applies. But that's really what the patent system is about. It's about being flexible and incorporating new and unforeseen technologies that will make our lives better.
But doesn't that give the authorities a little too much discretion to be able to decide whether something is a good invention or a bad invention?
Well, we've made a pretty big investment in getting people who are really smart and really well-trained. Examiners in the patent office, as I said, have technical backgrounds. We have really well-trained judges in a special court, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, that handles all of the patent appeals in the United States. So they have got a lot of experience dealing with patents. So we've made a big investment in getting experienced people who we think can make the right decision. And I think the Supreme Court is going to tell us that they need the discretion to be able to accommodate these new technologies. Certainly that's what the Supreme Court has told us in recent cases dealing with obviousness, in recent cases dealing with other patentable doctrines, that you got to be flexible, you can't be too rigid. And I think they're going to tell the Federal Circuit, stop being so rigid, guys.
And can obviousness be enough? Can that be enough of a gatekeeper to keep bogus inventions from being patented?
Well, on my view, and what Professor Lemley and I argue in the book, is that there are a whole series of gates that you can use. You could use obviousness. You can use other doctrines in patent law, like the disclosure requirements that Lester talked about before, to keep things that are too abstract out of the patent system. You can use a number of other, we call them policy levers, you know, different parts of the patent law. So there are lots of tools available to keep bad things out of the patent system besides just this subject matter requirement that we're talking about.
Lester, final thoughts?
Thank you, Evan.
Okay, we are out of time here. It's The Docket on KUCI and KUCI.org. I want to thank Lester Savitt of Jones Day and Dan Burke of the UCI Law School. And for those of you who are waiting for your bar exam results, good luck. It's The Docket on KUCI and KUCI.org. And I'm Evan Simon.
Hey, this is Dr. Michael Drake, Chancellor at the University of California, Irvine, and you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and over the web at KUCI.org. I love Anita Radio.
Fairy residents, Tooth speaking. Sorry, there's no credit fairy here. What's that? He magically raises your credit score? Yeah, there's no credit fairy. But you can improve your credit by paying bills on time and keeping your credit card balances low.